Oh, well. So anyway, what we're going to cover today is concerning the Garden of Eden. We're going to continue that study. And as we continue our study, we're going to be looking at some of the things that lead us to further understanding and of the relationship between the Garden of Eden, the tabernacle, and the temple. And additionally, hopefully we'll be able to see how some of this applies to you and me. So the first, if you picked up one of the charts that's on the information table, you'll find that this is the first page of the charts that are there. And this is a view of the Jerusalem in the time of Jesus Christ. And what you find here is what's interesting is you have the... we'll see if this actually works. Nope. Oh, well. It was a good idea. But you'll see that to your right, you'll see a kind of a red, in this picture, a red square, a large red rectangle. And across from that is the Mount of Olives. And then you have, and what's interesting, you have the Mount of Olives, and where that red rectangle is the temple. That is the Temple Mount. And that's Mount Moriah. So we've mentioned these three mountains before. So you have the Mount of Olives, you have the Temple Mount where Solomon's temple was and where the temple was in the time of Jesus Christ, the rebuilt temple, the temple that Herod reconstructed. And then you have down at the bottom, you have what's called the Upper City, and that's a mountainous area as well. That would be what's called Mount Zion. Those are the three major mountains in the city of Jerusalem. They're all important, and they all have a part to play in the unfolding of what God is working out. So Mount Moriah is the mount that specifically belonged to God, and it belonged to him because that is where his home was on earth and would be again. You know, when Abraham was coming back after the defeat of the five kings, he came through the area of Jerusalem and he met the king of Jerusalem, the king of Salem, and conversed with him, and he brought out bread and wine, and he came through this particular city, and this is where Jesus Christ dwelt at that time. So this was when it was the land of Canaan before Israel ever moved there. The temple was built on Araunah's threshing floor. We talked about that last time where David, because of his sin in taking the census, God told him to go and buy this Araunah's threshing floor. And that's what became the Temple Mount. And this temple was built on the mount there, Mount Moriah, the Lord's Mount. And the mount became known as the Temple Mount. And the Mount of Olives is directly east of the Temple Mount across the Kidron Valley. So we have where you see the temple there, that rectangle, if you have your chart, you can look at it. And there's the Kidron Valley, which runs between the temple and the Mount of Olives. And then also, as you look at the distances here, the distances are not like Texas distances. You know, from here to El Paso, it's a long way. All right. From one side of Houston to the other is a long way. So these distances aren't quite as lengthy, and really from the temple to the Mount of Olives is only about a half mile. It's only about a half mile. So actually, you know, you might say 0.6 miles. And this gives you an idea of the distance there that was taking place. If you were to go to climb up the Mount of Olives, this is what you would see. You're on the Mount of Olives, and you're looking back toward Jerusalem. So the Mount of Olives is east of the Temple Mount, and you're looking back. And what you're going to see here is the Muslim holy place that's there at this particular time. But in ancient times and in the time of Christ, you would be looking back at the Temple of God. It seems likely that that Abraham built the altar of Genesis chapter 12, verses 8 and 9, on the Mount of Olives. And he built that altar there, and he's looking back west, and he's looking at the Temple Mount, where the temple, God's dwelling place, would be located 600 years later. And this was once, as he was looking back, he's looking at the place that was once the site of God's house, Bethel, and the location of the Garden of Eden. So the Temple Mount and the Garden of Eden are one and the same location. Because as we'll see here, and we look at the layout of the temple and where all of that was located and what it represents, you can see a tie-in between the two. We're going to see later why I'm pretty sure that that is where Abraham built that altar to sacrifice Isaac on. Now, the Garden of Eden was most probably on a mountain because, as you think about it, these rivers flowed out from the Garden of Eden. There was a river that flowed out, and it split into four rivers. Now, water finds its own level, so there's got to be a downhill slope there to a degree in order that the river is going to flow downhill, and then it spread out from there, from the area of the Garden of Eden. And it was most likely running, it most certainly was running downhill from there. And we're going to see here and look at the patterns that exist and see how these things relate. So as you think about the temple and the tabernacle, how many altars were related to the tabernacle and the temple? How many altars are related to the tabernacle and the temple? For most of my life in the church, we believe there were two. That's all we knew about were two. But when you look at it more carefully, you'll see that there are actually three. Now, as you look in this picture, you can't see three. As you look in this picture, you see the inside. I don't have my pointer. So anyway, you'll see that there's a little square box. You see the menorah. And then to the right of it, you see the showbread that's in the holy place. The area where the rectangular gold-colored boxes, that is the Holy of Holies. And then there's a little square up close to what would be the curtain that separates the two, the holy place from the holiest place. And that's the incense altar that was part of the temple. So there was the altar of incense. And then outside at the bottom of the picture, you have a square. And what that was the brazen altar. The brazen altar was... you have this thing doesn't work, so anyway.
There you go. Thought it worked, but... Thank you.
So anyway, this is the brazen altar. And this is where many of the offerings were made. The only thing that was offered on this was incense. And but here you have the brazen altar, and you had the animals that were sacrificed, and then they were placed here, and their whatever parts that God designated as part of the sacrifice was burned there. So, and it's one that we know quite well. Now, the third altar is called the Mifkad altar. The third altar is called the Mifkad altar, and It's how many of you have heard of the Mifkad altar? Most of us haven't. I have. My wife has. A few other people have. Most of us have not heard of that. And this third altar was called by the Jews the Mifkad altar. And this altar was located 2,000 cubits to the temple's east. 2,000 cubits from the temple's east. And from the temple east. And so if you look at that, if you picked up a copy of the handout, you see that little square there. And east of that, 2,000 cubits, was the Mifkad altar. In Jerusalem, measuring from the temple, that distance puts it across the Kidron Valley on the Mount of Olives. Now, I've included with the handout a picture. And this gives you an idea of what this looked like. And what you have here is you're looking back from the Mount of Olives toward Jerusalem and the temple. And you see that they built a bridge across the Kidron Valley. They built a bridge across the Kidron Valley, and you have an altar that was set up there. And here it portrays them making a sacrifice. At the time of Christ, an arch bridge crossed the Kidron Valley and led directly to this little-known altar. And the bridge was built to enable the priest to cross the Kidron Valley in order to avoid defiling the sacrifices they were carrying to be burned upon that little-known altar. So they wanted to make sure that the sacrifice was not defiled, so they set up this bridge to go across there to where this altar was located. And the little-known altar is of considerable importance to what we're going to talk about today. Some commentators refer to this particular altar as the altar of the red heifer. So this altar is where the red heifer was sacrificed. Let's go to... So is this in the Bible or is this something we just made up? Let's go to Nehemiah chapter 3, verse 31. Nehemiah chapter 3, verse 31. Now, this is not, Nehemiah is not associated with the first temple. Nehemiah would be associated with the second temple that was built after the return of the Jews from Babylon. But it's interesting, they built the walls, they built the temple, and it's interesting that this is mentioned in relationship to that. So let's go to Nehemiah chapter 3. Nehemiah chapter 3, verse 31. It says, after him, Malchijah, one of the goldsmiths, made repairs as far as the house of the Nethinim, and of the merchants in front of the Mifkad gate, and as far as the upper room at the corner. So, in Nehemiah's time, as they had rebuilt the temple, they had a gate called the Mifkad gate. And that was the gate that you went out in order to go to this Mifkad altar. So this was some, as they rebuilt the walls, they rebuilt the temple, this was part of what they rebuilt. And, you know, we look at it and we don't think about what it's saying or what significance of it is. In my Bible, it has a number 2 there by verse 31. And it says the literally Mifkad means inspection or recruiting. So what does that have to do with anything? Inspection or recruiting. So we see in Nehemiah's time, as the temple has been rebuilt and the wall of the city of Jerusalem has been rebuilt, they have established a gate, a way to access this third altar called Mifkad. Now, this is interestingly, as you think into the future, in the millennial kingdom, what does Ezekiel tell us? Ezekiel's speaking about the rebuilding of a great temple after Christ's return. Let's go to Ezekiel chapter 44. So Ezekiel chapter 44 is in the millennial context of Christ's kingdom and the rebuilding of the temple. Ezekiel chapter 44, verse 1. And it says, then he brought me back to the outer gate of the sanctuary, which faces toward the east, but it was shut. And if you do a little research as far as the outer gate, the word there, outward sanctuary, you might call it, it's the word Mifkad, the outward sanctuary. And the translators interpreted it for us and put the interpretation into the narration there and talks about looking toward the east. So this outer gate of the sanctuary, which faces toward the east. So there's this gate, and the word Mifkad is what it's is part of that particular verse. It's not, it doesn't say Mifkad, but if you look it up in the Hebrew, that's what it says. If you go back to chapter 43 and look at verse 21, it says, then you shall also take the bull of the sin offering and burn it in the appointed place of the temple outside the sanctuary. So you shall take the bullock also of the sin offering and shall burn it in the appointed place of the house again without the sanctuary. There is the word Mifkad again. So we see that the Mifkad altar had several different names, and we're going to see some other names for it as we go through this. But that is the technical name, the Mifkad altar, the third altar belonging to the temple, the tabernacle, and also to Eden. Incidentally, the Mifkad has a variety of applications. The application will change depending on the usage, on the context. It literally means numbering. It literally means numbering. But you might think, well, what does numbering mean? What does numbering have to do with anything? As we get to, as we sort this out more and we look at Jesus Christ and Jesus Christ, his significance and what took place in his life, then you'll see what numbering has to do. But others say appointed, and these are literal meanings. It also means inspection, like you would do in recruiting an army. You're going through and looking at individuals that you're going to recruit into your army. So who am I going to pick? And so you're doing an assessment. And it also means census. And that's very close to numbering. You know, as you take a census, you are numbering. And in all cases, though, it is suggesting judgment. Remember, David took a census, and he was most surely judged by God for doing that. And so there's a connection here with the word census. Well, let's go to Numbers chapter 19. Numbers chapter 19. And we'll begin in verse 1. Numbers chapter 19, verse 1. It says, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, 'This is the ordinance of the law which the Lord has commanded, saying, Speak to the children of Israel that they bring you a red heifer without blemish, in which there is no defect and on which a yoke has never come.'" So he's giving them instruction about a particular animal. It could have no blemish. It could have no defect. It could never have been used, harnessed and used to do plowing. No yoke has come upon it. "You shall give it to Eleazar the priest, that he may take it outside the camp, and it shall be slaughtered before him." So you took it outside the camp, and you slaughtered it before him. "And the Eleazar the priest shall take some of its blood with his finger, and sprinkle some of its blood seven times directly in front of the tabernacle of meeting. Then the heifer shall be burned in his sight. Its hide, its flesh, its blood, and its offal shall be burned. And the priest shall take cedar wood and hyssop and scarlet and cast them into the midst of the fire, burning the heifer. Then the priest shall wash his clothes, he shall bathe in water, and afterward he shall come into the camp, and the priest shall be unclean until evening." So, you know what? So whatever this sacrifice was, this heifer that was sacrificed, it obviously has to do with sin. And by the priest being associated with it, he became unclean. So he was unclean until evening. Verse 8, "And the one who burns it shall wash his clothes in water, bathe in water, and shall be unclean until evening." So the person who burns it was also unclean, had to wash his clothes, and he was unclean until evening. Verse 9, "Then a man who is clean shall gather up the ashes of the heifer and store them outside the camp in a clean place, and they shall be kept for the congregation of the children of Israel for the water of purification. It is for purifying from sin." So all of this, the sacrifice of the heifer and the gathering of the ashes and the keeping of those ashes in a clean place, all had to do with rites of purification, that the cleansing from sin that took place in Israel. So as we look at this, we see that this took place on the Mifkad altar, a clean place, there's a clean place here, not the altar itself, but the area around the altar. There was a clean place there, and it shall be kept for the congregation of the children of Israel, for a water of separation. It is a purification for sin. And just to portray this for you, here we have you see the temple in the background, you see the priest here, and you see the red heifer. So when they brought the red heifer and they got it into place, they just very quickly killed the heifer. They very quickly killed it and got some of the blood which they would use to sprinkle in front of the temple or the tabernacle. And this is a picture of the red heifer. The red heifer could have no blemishes. It had never been hooked to a yoke, and it was virginal in every respect. It was led alive by the priest across the Kidron Valley by way of the bridge to the Mifkat altar, located on the southern peak of the Mount of Olives. And then it was unceremoniously killed. And a small amount of the blood was caught and then sprinkled seven times toward the temple or the tabernacle. The animal was then completely burned without being skinned or cut up in any way. And then it was placed there on the altar, and the flames consumed every part of it, including its dung. Nothing was excluded from the fire. And it's a reminder to all of us that, Christ was a representative of Christ. And Christ was the complete sacrifice for sin. He gave all for the sins of humanity. And then we have a portrayal here. You have cedar, you have hyssop, and you have some scarlet. And it was while the animal was being consumed by the flames, the priest added cedar wood, he added hyssop, and he added scarlet to the mix. And once the animal was completely devoured by the flames, its ashes were collected, mixed with pure water, and set aside probably in the same general location, the clean place, used for the purification rites. And it was used to purify from sin, as it speaks about in verse 9. And no part of it was ever brought into the camp. No part of it was ever brought into the camp. And we're not going to analyze what it means by the camp today, but we will later on. It had to be kept, these waters of purification, outside the camp, never to be brought in. Now, let's look at Leviticus chapter 4. Leviticus chapter 4. And here we see the instructions of sin offerings that are to be burned on the brazen altar. And the reason I'm turning to this is because there are descriptions of four sin offerings in Leviticus 4, in which the main difference is who committed the sin. Otherwise, they're identical, and the one who committed the sin is going to determine how the priest were to proceed. Now let's look at chapter 4 and begin in verse 1. It says, "Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel, saying, If a person sins unintentionally against any of the commandments of the Lord in anything which ought not to be done and does any of them, for example, and this gives us a specific example, if the anointed priest sins, bringing guilt on the people, then let him offer to the Lord for his sin, which he has sinned, a young bull without blemish as a sin offering." So if the priest sinned, then he was to offer a bull as a sin offering. "He shall bring the bull to the door of the tabernacle of meeting before the Lord, lay his hands on the bull's head." So here's an instance of laying on of hands. So he was to lay his hands on the bull's head. All right. And kill the bull before the Lord. So in laying on his hands on the bull, I'm sure he would say what the sin was that was being placed on the bull. That's a type of Christ. "Then the anointed priest shall take some of the bull's blood and bring it to the tabernacle of meeting. The priest shall dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle some of the blood seven times before the Lord in front of the veil of the sanctuary." So he would take some of that blood and sprinkle it with his finger seven times. "And the priest shall put some of the blood on the horns of the altar." So if you looked at the brazen altar, you had horns, and they would put some of the blood on each one of the horns of the brazen altar. The fat that, and he shall, and then it says, "And the priest shall put some of the blood on the horns of the altar of sweet incense before the Lord, which is in the tabernacle of meeting." So he's going to put it on that And if you look at that incense altar, it had like four little horns on both. All the altars had those horns on them. And he shall pour the remaining blood of the bull at the base of the altar of the burnt offering. So he puts blood on the incense offering. Then he goes out to the brazen offering and pours the blood out. He shall take from it all the fat of the bull as the sin offering, the fat that covers the entrails and all the fat which is on the entrails, the two kidneys and the fat that is on them by the flanks, and the fatty lobe attached to the liver above the kidneys he shall remove. As it was taken from the bull of the sacrifice of the peace offering, and the priest shall burn them on the altar of the burnt offering. So there were certain things that were going to be put on the brazen altar, that altar that was there at the in front of the temple or tabernacle. And then it says, but the bull's hide and all its flesh, with its head and legs, its entrails and offal, the whole bull he shall carry outside the camp to a clean place. He shall go outside the camp to a clean place where the ashes are poured out, and burn it on wood with fire. Where the ashes are poured out, it shall be burned. So this, where he's taking it, where does he take it outside the camp to burn it? He's taking it out to this third altar, the Mifkad altar. So part of it was burned on the altar right there in front of the temple. The rest of it was taken outside the camp to this third altar, the Mifkad altar, and sacrificed there. So as you go on, it's in verse 13, it says, now if the whole congregation of Israel sins unintentionally, and the thing is hidden from the eyes of the assembly, and they have done something against any of the commandments of the Lord and anything which should not be done and are guilty, when the sin which they have committed becomes known, then the assembly shall offer a young bull for the sin and bring it before the tabernacle of meeting, and the elders of the congregation shall lay their hands on the head of the bull before the Lord. So the sin is being transferred to the bull in type. Then the bull shall be killed before the Lord. The anointed priest shall bring some of the bull's blood to the tabernacle of meeting. Then the priest shall dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle it seven times before the Lord in front of the veil. And he shall put some of the blood on the horns of the altar which is before the Lord, which is in the tabernacle of meeting. And he shall pour the remaining blood at the base of the altar of the burnt offering. So it's the same procedure, except the sacrifices for the congregation of Israel and their sin. And then it goes on to say, and he shall take all of the fat from it and burn it on the altar. And he shall do with the bull as he did with the bull as a sin offering. And thus he shall do with it, so the priest shall make atonement for them, and it shall be forgiven them. So they're going to take the part of that and sacrifice it on the and burn it on the brazen altar there. And then they're going to take the rest out to that third altar. So probably, you know, we look at this and we're thinking, who cares? You know, what is it? Why is this significant? But you have to stop and think, well, wait a minute. God inspired this to be written down. He didn't have to put this in here. He didn't just put it in there to bore us. Who cares? Who cares? You know, why do we need this? God's trying to show us something and help to illustrate something to us that's significant. And these sacrifices were significant because of what they pointed us to in relationship to Jesus Christ. And that's where we're ultimately going to go, is look at how all of this ties into Jesus Christ and the Garden of Eden and what's ultimately to be worked out. So as you think about the temple was God's dwelling place. And as we've seen here, we look at these two sin offerings, the one for the priest and the one for the whole congregation. And when that meat was taken across the bridge, what direction were they headed? So if they make the sacrifice there before the temple, and then they burn part of it on the brazen altar right here, and then, so part of it's sacrificed here, and then where are they going to take the other part of it? They're going to take it through the Mifkad gate in Christ's time, go across the bridge to that other altar, and they're going to burn it there. And what direction were they going? For instance, what direction does the temple face? North, south, east, or west? faces east. Always remember that you have the temple and it's facing the Mount of Olives. And the Mount of Olives is to the east of the temple. And that's something that's significant. And as you look at them taking the for instance, the offering that was made for the priest, they're carrying it away from God. They're moving it away from God. And God's saying, basically, I'm disgusted with this sin. And it's being carried away from Him and the sacrifice being made. So, as you think about this, hopefully you've caught the picture, but as you think about this, back in the back of the temple here is, we don't have the diagram, we'll go to that here shortly, is the Holy of Holies. And God is, it portrays God sitting there between the two cherubs above that box called the Ark of the Covenant, representing His throne. And as you think about that, every sacrifice that was made was in front, directly in front of God. All of them took place within His sight. Those at the brazen altar and across the Kidron Valley to the Mifkat altar, God's looking directly on every sacrifice that took place. All right? Every one of them. And that's a significant issue. And it'll kind of help you understand, it's important to keep that in mind as we think about, well, where did the sacrifice of Jesus Christ take place? So, as you look at this, God is looking on every sacrifice that took place because it represents the ultimate. They all represented the ultimate sacrifice that would be made by Jesus Christ. As we move on here, if you look on your chart, I did give everybody a copy of this so you can kind of understand how this all unfolds. And, we're going to take further looks into the design of the Garden of Eden itself and into the threefold design of the tabernacle and temple, looking from east to west, that is, front to back. So this is God's dwelling place in the western part of the tabernacle or temple. When they set up the tabernacle, which was the tent that they carried with them, whenever they set it up, it was always facing east. It was always facing east. It was laid out the same way every time. They didn't just set up, well, which way do you want to set it up this way, this week, guys? No, there was no choice. You set it up a certain way because of what it represented. And then you have the holy place, and in here is the incense altar, you have the showbread, and you have the menorah or the candle. And then this is the outside court. You have the brazen altar, and sometimes you have the brazen altar here. Sometimes the sea of bronze is in this area. It just depends on how it's portrayed. And there are different ways it's portrayed. And none of these, I'm saying that, staking my life on the fact that these are exact, but they give us an idea of how things were done in regard to the temple. So you have an entryway, a doorway here into the holy place. And you can only get to the most holy place, the Holy of Holies, by going behind a curtain. And the priest could only go in there once a year, as we know, on the Feast of the Day of Atonement. And then through these doors, you have this altar here. Now, we're going to talk about the relationship between the Garden of Eden, the tabernacle, and the temple. And there is a relationship which is important for us to understand. Again, God gives us insight into these things in order that we can put them together and understand certain things about the way He's working His plan of salvation out and what these things represent. As you think about this, we talked about the camp, and the Garden of Eden was the camp. And as I said, we're not going to talk about exactly what that means yet, but we will get to that. The camp was a word that was assigned back in the Old Testament to the area surrounding the tabernacle. But the term continued right on through to the temple and of Jesus' day. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 12, or excuse me, Hebrews chapter 13, verse 12. Hebrews chapter 13, verse 12. And see, Paul, who we think was the writer of the book of Hebrews, Paul was able to understand these things. Paul was able to understand these things and to help to explain the tie-in between New Testament symbols and Old Testament symbols and help people in their understanding. Look at chapter 13, verse 12. It says, "Therefore Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people with his own blood, suffered outside the gate. Therefore Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people who suffered outside the gate. Therefore, let us go forth to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach." So here's Paul talking about this idea of the camp. Let's go outside the camp. So to what altar is he pointing? To what altar is Paul pointing us? You go back to Hebrews chapter 9 and look at verse 2. Hebrews chapter 9 and look at verse 2. It speaks here, "For a tabernacle was prepared, the first part, in which was the lampstand, the table, and the showbread, which is called the sanctuary. And behind, the second veil, the part of the tabernacle, which is called the holiest of all." So you have, Paul is describing these things and seeking to get the people who were Christians at that time to understand these things. If we think about it, in Genesis chapter 2, verse 9, and Genesis 3, verse 3, that both of those verses show that the tree of life was in, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil were in the midst of the garden. They were in the midst of the garden. And the term, the midst of the garden, is equivalent to the Holy of Holies of the tabernacle in the temple. Where God walked, he was walking in the midst of the garden. And that was the house, and both the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil were in the garden. They were in his dwelling place. The midst of the garden and the Holy of Holies were parallels to each other. They were parallels to each other. And we might wonder how closely God followed the heavenly abode pattern on earth as compared to heaven. How closely did he follow? For example, in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 22, it shows that in heaven, it has a Mount Zion. It speaks of Mount Zion, the heavenly Jerusalem, and Mount Zion. So the Mount Zion on earth is a type of what's in heaven. Let's think of another example here in regard to God's house and things that are found there. This example involves God's house and cherubim. And we know that in Genesis chapter 3, the sin of Adam and Eve took place and they were expelled from the garden. They were expelled from the garden. And God pronounced certain curses on them. And how did God ensure that they would not come back into the garden and have access to the tree of life? How did he do that? Well, we know that the Bible tells us that he set up cherubim there to protect the entryway into the garden. Let's look at something interesting about the cherubim and God. Let's go to Ezekiel chapter 1. And look at verses 4 and 5. Ezekiel chapter 1, and look at verses 4 and 5. And Ezekiel 1 begins in a most dramatic way when you stop and think about it. Ezekiel 1, verse 4 says, "Then I looked, and behold, a whirlwind was coming. Out of the north, a great cloud with raging fire engulfing itself, and brightness was all around it, and radiating out of its midst like the color of amber out of the midst of the fire. Also from within it came the likeness of four living creatures, and this was the appearance they had, the likeness of a man. Each one had four faces, each one had four wings. And their legs were straight, and the soles of their feet were like the soles of calves' feet. They sparkled like the color of burnished brass." So here comes this whirlwind that Ezekiel was given the opportunity to see. It was a vision that he was able to see. And he sees these four living creatures. Let's go down to verse 10. As for the likeness of their faces, each had the face of a man. Each of the four had the face of a lion. On the right side, each had the four had the face of an ox. On the left side, and each of the four had the face of an eagle. So they had these four different faces. And let's go to chapter, and what Ezekiel is describing here are cherubim. Now, let's go to Ezekiel chapter 10. Ezekiel chapter 10, verses 19 and 20. It says, "And the cherubim lifted their wings and mounted up from the earth in my sight. When they went out, the wheels were beside them, and they stood at the door of the east gate of the Lord's house. The glory of the God of Israel was above them. This is the living creature I saw under the God of Israel by the river Kibar, and I knew they were cherubim." So he saw these cherubim there. And what he saw was that these four cherubim carried Christ. It was like, his throne's there, and they carry him from one place to another. Ezekiel saw in chapter 1, what he saw in chapter 1 was God apparently on his heavenly chariot, charging about, and Ezekiel saw this in vision. He saw God and also the cherubim associated with God, and it seems to be a pattern that wherever you find God, you will find cherubim. You'll find cherubim there. And they, you know, are his servants. They are ministering spirits, and they minister to the sons of salvation, and they also minister to God. Let's look in chapter 4 of Revelation. Revelation chapter 4. Revelation chapter 4. And let's begin, look in verse 1. Revelation chapter 4, verse 1. It says, "And these things, and after these things I looked, and behold, a door standing open in heaven. And the first voice which I heard was like a trumpet speaking with me, saying, 'Come up here, and I will show you things which must take place after this.' Immediately I was in the Spirit, and behold, a throne set in heaven, and one sat on the throne." Then let's go down to verse 6. "Before the throne there was a sea of glass like crystal, and in the midst of the throne and around the throne were four living creatures, full of eyes in front and in back. The first living creature was like a lion, the second living creature like a calf, the third living creature had a face like a man, and the fourth living creature like an eagle, like a flying eagle." So what would you think those are based upon what you've seen in the book of Ezekiel? You would say it's describing cherubim. And where do we find them? We find them at God's throne. We find them at God's throne. And what I'm getting at here is that cherubim are so closely associated with God that when we see him in his glorious picture like this, everywhere he is, we find the cherubim to be there. And interestingly, where was God on earth? He was in the Garden of Eden, and we find cherubim there as well. So there is a Mount Zion in heaven, and when God came to earth in that capacity, he brought the cherubim with him. And so you look at them in one place, and they're at the throne in heaven. You look at them in another place, and they're traveling through the universe on their way to do something, and you see them again, and they're in the Garden of Eden as well. So it doesn't seem that the cherubim are directly associated with the presence of God, especially with respect to his throne, wherever it might be located at any given time. Now we go back to Solomon's temple. The tabernacle and temple's brazen altars were located just outside the east entrance. You can see here, east entrance, there's the altar. The brazen altar is just outside the east entrance. And did the garden have any such thing? Was there a brazen altar outside the garden? Well, the answer is it did. It was located just outside the midst of the garden and outside what Paul called the first part in Hebrews 9:2. And this is the first part here, just outside the first part right there. But still, part of the garden compares with the outer court of the temple. Part of the garden is the outer court of the tabernacle. And we might recall that Adam and Eve were cast out of the Garden of Eden. Let's go to Genesis chapter 4 and look at verse 3. So they're cast out of the garden, and in what direction did they go? What direction did they go? They went east. They went east. Let's go to Genesis chapter 4. And Genesis chapter 4 is the first mention of a sacrifice. And it says in verse 3, "And in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. Abel also brought of the firstborn of the flock and of their fat. And the Lord respected Abel and his offering. But he did not respect Cain and his offering, and Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell." So this is the first mention of an offering. And I think we can understand from this that Adam and Eve also made offerings. And it doesn't say that Cain and Abel had to build this altar. It was already built, and they came to it at the appointed time. So there was a specific time they were to come and to make an offering. Now, as we've discussed in the past, I think that was at Passover time. But that's just speculation. I don't know that for sure. But due to a number of different things, it seems to make sense. So Adam and Eve had made sacrifices, and as responsible parents, they had passed along the symbolism of this and the need to make sacrifice to their children. They knew this was a duty to God. So I say this because the way the sacrifices of Cain and Abel are introduced, a background of their understanding is assumed. You know, there, like I said, there was an appointed time and a set time in which they were to come and make sacrifice. And these sacrifices would have taken place within the land of Eden, but outside the garden. And, you know, if you look at this and it's a type of the garden, this is outside the garden, but close to the garden. And that they made sacrifices there to God. We go on to verses 6 and 7. And it says here, "So the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry, and why has your countenance fallen? And in verse 7 it says, if you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it." And this may, you know, as you think about this, does this have anything to do with what we're talking about today? Well, as we go through this, it's important to what's going to unfold in relationship to this pattern and Jesus Christ. Despite the fact that Cain was absolutely wrong in what he did, and he was angry because his sacrifice was not accepted, God said to him that's actually positive. He said, "If you do well, shall you not be accepted? If you do well, you will be accepted." We can understand that. Then he adds, "If you do not well, sin lies at the door." That's what the King James Version has God saying. That is, and as you think about that, it's something redundant, and the reason it's redundant is because Cain had already not done well. All right, he already had a bad attitude. He was angry. He was already wrong. So there's something that he could but there was something that he could do at this point. He had not done well, but there was something that he could do. And what it's describing here is an ongoing event, something that's unfolding with Abel's sacrifice and then Cain's sacrifice and God's rejecting Cain's sacrifice and Cain's reaction and God speaking to him. So this whole thing is unfolding. At the time that it occurred, was there something that Cain could do at that point that would be approved by God and all would be well? What could Cain do that would allow all to be well? Remember, he just asked him, if you do something and you do well, you will be approved. Think about what started this whole thing. It was his sin that started all of this dialogue. And in this congregation, sin is not lying at the door. It's already present. He's already sinned. It was already there. But God says something lies at the door, and it is something that has to do with sin. So let's consider Adam and Eve. All right? And by looking at them, it helps to explain what's taking place here. Following their sin, their mind was changed, and they knew that they were naked. They sinned, and they knew that they were naked. And that nakedness was for them an indication that they indeed had sinned. So what did they do? Hey, these fig leaves are pretty big. We'll cover ourselves with them. And but fig leaves aren't really good for covering yourself up. I'm not sure how they got them to stick. I'm sure they didn't have glue. They didn't have needles. They didn't have thread. I don't know how they got them to stick. Maybe they got sticks and who knows what they did. But anyway, they had to innovate. Yeah, but they're not good for covering sin. So what did God do? God confronts them. And he says to them, who told you that you sinned and that you were naked? And so what did they answer? Well, she made me sin. It was Satan's fault. Well, it's, you know, they're blaming each other. They're blaming Satan. And what did God do? God covered them. God covered them. And what did he do to cover them? He killed an animal. He shed blood and covered them with the skins. And he made coverings for them. It's interesting that he made them. So he killed the animal. He skinned it. And he used the skins to cover them. So, you know, how long did he allow that somehow he quickly cure the skins and all of that and make them so they would be appropriate, you know, easy to put on? I don't know. But it's interesting that Adam and Eve had to stand there and watch God do this. And so maybe God was making a point with them as he made the sacrifice and covered them. But that's what he did. He shed blood and then covered them with the skins. Now we come to Cain and Abel. Now God said that if you do not well, a sin offering lies at the door. Because that's what was needed. How could he be reconciled to God unless a sin offering was made? And God offered it to Cain, a sin offering. And if you look at Genesis chapter 4, verse 7 in Young's literal translation, it says, there is there not, if you do well, acceptance? And if you do not well, at the opening, a sin offering is crouching. And unto you its desire, and you rule over it. You have the choice of whether you're going to have the sin offering applied to your sin. If you do not do well, you need a sin offering. And that is really what he said to them, if you sin, an offering lies at the door. The word lies is quite expressive. As some translators will say that sin crouches, not lies. But crouches at the door. And because they can see that there's some significance to what is being said here that ties in with a sin offering. What they would say is, say, crouch, which incidentally is a reasonable translation, because the sin offering, as the wording is there, gives the impression that it is under a tremendous burden. You know, if you put the sin on what is crouching there, then it carries that burden. It's transferred to the animal there. And so God was offering Cain an offering to be slain and burned on the altar. It's interesting what Adam Clark says about this. He quotes the verse, and then he brings up the point, if you do well. He says, that which is right in the sight of God shall you not be accepted. Does God reject any man who serves him in simplicity and godly sincerity? But if you do not well, can wrath and indignation against your righteous brother save you from the displeasure under which you are fallen? On the contrary, have recourse to the Maker for mercy. So you need to turn to God, Cain, and ask for his mercy. And he quotes the Hebrew there, which I could read to you, but I'm just going to read it poorly, and you're not going to know what it says anyway. So what he says is, a sin offering lies at the door. That's what he says. A sin offering lies at the door. An animal proper to be offered as an atonement for sin is now crouching at the door of the fold. So the words there frequently signify sin. But Adam Clark says, I have observed more than 100 places in the Old Testament where they are used for sin offering and translated hamartia in the Septuagint, which is a word for sin in Greek, which is the term used by Paul in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 21, where it says, he made him to be sin, hamartian, a sin offering for us who knew no sin. Cain's fault now was his not bringing a sin offering when his brother brought one, and his neglect and contempt caused his other offering to be rejected. You see, he was to bring a sin offering, and he was unwilling to do so. So, for whatever reason, however, God graciously informs him that though he had miscarried, his case was not yet desperate, as the means of faith from the promise were in his power, and a victim proper for a sin offering was lying like a sheep or a lamb there, a quadruped, at the door of his fold. So God's telling Cain, there is a sacrifice for sin. I'm going to allow that what is crouching there to be your sin offering. So here's the question that I'll leave you with here. Which altar, when he talks about this, is he referring to? Is he talking about the brazen altar? Since God was offering Cain forgiveness and grace so that he could be relieved of this penalty that was being imposed upon him, what altar was he referring to that lies at the door? Was it the brazen altar that we see here in this first picture, just outside the entrance to Eden's inner parts? Or is there a possibility that the door God was referring to was the Mifkad altar? We will explore more about this altar and its meaning and other things regarding the temple and tabernacle in the next study. So thank you for your attention. Hopefully that's profitable. And we'll pick this up next time.